for another day. It's only you could have taken me through. I owe it all to you. I know it's only you. Only you could have carried me through now. I owe it all to you. I know it's only you. When the thoughts of losing hope arise, I close my eyes and above the waves I rise. The rainbow tells me there is no reason to cry. Promise, hope, and faith, these colors signify.
There is this thing going on.
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news are brought to you live.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show, a part of CKUT's Off the Hour. Prison Radio has been on the air for more than 10 years. Prison Radio seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggle by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging our ideas about what are prisons and the people inside our jails. Prison Radio is dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. This is in the interest of forging stronger ties with incarcerated and non-incarcerated people, ensuring that prisoners have direct control over their representation and that our understanding of prisons be informed by those who live inside their walls. We invite anyone who is interested in collaborating on programming to contact us. Those who have been affected by the prison system in any way are encouraged to get involved. You can email news@ckut.ca or prison@ckut.ca, or you can call us at 514-448-4041, extension 6788. You're listening to CKUT, Montreal Community Campus Radio, located on 90.3 FM on the dial, and www.ckut.ca online.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Virginia.
My name is Noah.
And we're your hosts for today's show. Today on the Prison Radio Show, we will be rebroadcasting part of a recent episode from CFRC Kingston's Prison Radio about youth detention. We will also be rebroadcasting part of a recent episode of WFHB's Kite Line about support systems for communities directly affected or targeted by police and prison systems. We are going to start the show with some news.
Longtime activist and former political prisoner Lynn Stewart has died at the age of 77. Stewart was a civil rights lawyer who was known for her defense of quote-unquote revolutionaries, including members of Black Panthers and the Weather Underground. She was sentenced to 10 years in prison in 2012 after being convicted of quote-unquote aiding terrorism for having distributed press releases and smuggled messages in her defense of one of her clients, Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman. Stewart was held in federal prison for 4 years before finally being granted compassionate release in 2014 due to having metastatic breast cancer that was deemed to be terminal and having been given only 8 months to live at the time. Stewart continued her work and continued to speak out for political prisoners and other causes after her release from prison.
According to the Globe and Mail, British Columbia will transfer responsibility for prisoner care from its public safety portfolio to its health ministry. That will make it the third province after Alberta and Nova Scotia to put prison medical needs under its health portfolio. This change is being done in a purported effort to increase healthcare, mental healthcare, and substance use support for prisoners in BC's prison system. This shift in how healthcare for prisoners will be handled also comes in response to numerous grievances raised about the BC health system's inability to provide proper, adequate support for prisoners. A report put out last year by the John Howard Society cited similar issues in Ontario and called healthcare for prisoners there parallel but unequal. The Office of the Correctional Investigator similarly reports that federally, healthcare delivery is the number one complaint for prisoners. Up next, we will be rebroadcasting a recent piece from CFRC Kingston's Prison Radio Show about a proposed class action lawsuit related to solitary confinement in youth detention. In it, host Rico speaks to Scott Robinson, a lawyer in Toronto, who's involved in a lawsuit against the province of Ontario and all third-party youth detention operators, including the St. Lawrence Youth Association, who CFRC Kingston also interviewed for the same show. To hear their entire episode, you can visit cfrcprisonradio.wordpress.com.
My name is Scott Robinson. I'm an associate lawyer at the law firm of Kosky Minsky in Toronto, and a significant department of our firm does strictly plaintiff side class action litigation. A majority of our cases kind of have a social justice bent, including a significant practice against Crown actors, be it Canada, Ontario, or other provinces.
And you're working on it's called the Youth Confinement Class Action, correct?
It's a pre-certification class action, so it's a proposed class proceeding. We started the case in fall of 2015, and we've been proceeding ever since. And it alleges breach of fiduciary duty, negligence, and breaches of various sections of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms against Ontario on account of the placement of youths in, we would call it solitary confinement, in youth justice facilities in Ontario. Our claim captures 23 of those facilities.
Okay, so can you break down that terminology a bit in terms of solitary confinement versus secure isolation versus administrative segregation? Why do we have so many different terms for essentially the same thing?
You know, solitary confinement, I would say, is small s, small c, solitary confinement. The secure isolation is capital S, capital I, secure isolation. Administrative segregation is used in the federal context. You know, these are just terms that are taken from the various acts or regulations to those acts.
This followed a report by the Provincial Advocate for Children and Youth that saw pretty high levels of long-term use of secure isolation in these facilities, right?
Our firm has been following, you know, it's undeniable in the last, you know, 10 years, certainly the last 5 years, there's been a very clear trend against the use of solitary confinement, not only in Canadian prisons, but, you know, the world over, right? So our firm has been following that quite closely and acting accordingly. You know, for example, we have another proposed class proceeding on the go right now against Canada on account of the use of, I'm going to call it solitary confinement, against prisoners with mental illnesses, right? Another vulnerable population. And so it's something that we've been looking at for quite some time and been monitoring it. And, you know, the sentiment against the use of solitary confinement has only been growing in recent years. You know, in 2012, the Ontario Auditor General released a report that was highlighting the improper use of solitary confinement in many of the Ontario youth justice facilities. In 2013, the Provincial Advocate for Children and Youth released a report particularly targeting the Roy McMurtry Youth Center. And then last year was really it's a report from the Advocate for Children and Youth titled It's a Matter of Time, which was a systemic review of secure isolation in Ontario youth justice facilities. That really, really put the microscope on the use of this practice in Ontario youth justice facilities. When that report was launched, that could be seen as, you know, the final tipping point that caused us to launch this case. It's a very, very topical issue, very serious issue, and I think an issue that the public needs to be more aware about.
And do you think this started in Canada with the Ashley Smith inquest? Is that where this current sort of wave of backlash has come from?
I don't know if it started there. That certainly put it on the front page of the newspapers, that's for sure. But I do think, you know, that various public interest organizations have been speaking out against this in Canada and internationally for quite some time, right? You look at the Canadian Medical Association has had a comment on this. The United Nations certainly have what they purport to be rules with respect to the use of solitary confinement on youth.
Are you hoping to see the practice abolished in youth facilities altogether?
You know, I don't want to speak too much about what the expectations of the case are. It's still very early in the case, so I want to be careful on that point. There certainly is a problem with the way that Ontario is administering it right now. You know, the UN, for example, calls for a complete abolition of it. Our case is framed more against Ontario for the negligent systemic operation of the system.
There's laws in Ontario that protect the identities of youth who get involved in that system. So have you found it difficult to actually find plaintiffs?
It hasn't been the easiest case to find other people that have been harmed in a common way. They certainly are out there. But the way that Ontario class proceedings work, and most class proceeding regimes throughout Canada work, is it's called an opt-out regime as opposed to an opt-in. If that is certified, then anyone who meets that class definition is, by default, captured by the class action. So you don't need to sign up, per se. There's a notice regime that goes out, and people can then opt out of the class action if they want. But basically, the default is inclusion as opposed to exclusion in Ontario class actions, and that certainly assists us procedurally in a case like this.
Are you able to speak to why the UN recommends not using solitary confinement on youth?
I'm not able to give, you know, specific reasons for why that is the case. That is, you know, that happens to be one of the various groups that have given their opinion on it. Generally, you could probably see a complete prohibition from the UN on the use of solitary confinement on A, mentally ill prisoners, and then B, effectively any person under the age of 18. That's kind of the way that for example, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture has given that opinion. But other groups, if they haven't taken a complete prohibition, they've certainly given their opinion to curb the use thereof.
Right, yeah, we've seen the John Howard Society come out, the BC Civil Liberties Association.
Yeah, the Canadian Medical Association, for example, has been quite clear that it'll certainly, in their view, contribute to further anxiety, depression, anger being instilled in the youth. And the youth population is going to be inherently vulnerable just given their age and the stage of development, right? So solitary confinement may have, you know, X amount of effect on a fully grown person, let's say, right? Both physical and mental effect. Well, it's pretty clear that effect is going to be only exacerbated on a youth, and especially in their formative period, right?
So this seems to be sort of all across the board a pretty a major shift seems to be happening.
You know, you check any newspaper almost every day, there seems to be something new about it. If not in Canada, then on the international level. So there does undeniably, outside of the courts, yeah, you know, let's just say even on a social level, there does seem to be an undeniable trend against the use of this practice. If a particular organization doesn't advocate for a complete abolition or prohibition, they certainly advocate for a change to the way that it is administered, that's for sure. This is, as I said earlier, this is an incredibly important and topical case, in our view. This is in keeping with, as we said, a clear trend, both domestically and internationally, for some changes to the way that this practice is administered.
That was Scott Robinson doing an interview for CFRC Kingston's Prison Radio Show. He was speaking about a lawsuit that he's a part of that's concerning solitary confinement in youth detention centers. To listen to that entire episode, you can visit cfrcprisonradio.wordpress.com.
The time is presently 5:15 p.m., and you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca.
MediaQueer.ca presents two free screenings at Concordia University in March. Join us on Saturday, March 4th at 2 p.m. for a rare screening of Clement Virgo's Rude, the first Black-directed and Black-starring feature film in Canada. Also, don't miss Dana Ingster's Welcome to Africville, a documentary about mid-century Black queer sexualities before demolition and gentrification. A co-presentation by Dawson College student group Legacy and Massimadi Montréal.
Then on Friday, March 10th at 6:30 p.m., Media Queer and the Mel Oppenheim School of Cinema are proud to present the Montreal premiere of This Is Gay Propaganda, LGBT Rights and the War in Ukraine by Marusa Borsukiv. Following the struggle of LGBTQ people after the Russian invasion of Donetsk in 2014, Borsukiv will discuss feminist and queer solidarity in Ukraine during the Q&A with CKUT's Tamara Filievich after the screening. Both events are free and will be held at Concordia University's Visual Arts Building, 1395 Rue Nelévêque West, in Auditorium VA114. For more information, go to www.mediaqueer.ca. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
Israeli Apartheid Week 2017, March 6th to 15th. At campuses and community spaces across Montreal. Join us for 10 days of workshops, conferences, panels, film screenings, cultural events and demonstrations aiming to raise awareness around the boycott, divestment and sanctions campaign against Israeli apartheid, featuring panels on profiling Arabs and Muslims, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, and reclaiming queer Arab stories, workshops on indigenous womanisms and feminisms, and Occupation 101, film screenings including Ambulance and the Wanted 18, Palestine Block, and the International Women's Day demonstration. That's March 6th to 15th at campuses and community spaces across Montreal. More information is available at iawmontreal.org. Israeli Apartheid Week 2017, a CKUT co-presentation.
Next up, we have part of a recent episode of Kiteline, which is a radio show from WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana. This episode was focused on support systems for communities who are directly affected or targeted by law enforcement and incarceration, and specifically featured two people who are working to organize these kinds of support systems.
It's been 16 years that he's been gone, and so we've had to create a different way of validating family. And if you love a person, then you can't just walk away. It's not that simple. It's not easy.
Welcome to Kiteline, a weekly radio program from WFHB that focuses on issues in Indiana's prison system and beyond.
I'm Emma Johnson.
And I'm Mia Beach, and we're your hosts for this program.
Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to the guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here on Kiteline, we hope to share these words across the prison walls. This week's episode will focus on two individuals who are working to organize support systems for communities that are directly affected or targeted by law enforcement and incarceration. Last week, we began a conversation with Akili Shakur, activist and wife of Indiana prisoner Shaka Shakur. This episode, we continue our conversation with Akili, and she tells us more about the specific difficulties and challenges that she and many others who have loved ones behind bars experience. After that, we will hear from Willie Palomo, a graduate student and member of the Ndaki Hoosier Alliance at Indiana University Bloomington. Willie will share his thoughts and concerns about the recent raids targeting undocumented communities across the U.S.
I'm Akili Shakur, wife of Shaka Shakur, an inmate in the Indiana Department of Corrections. I've been with Shaka 16 years. I don't make no excuses, or I'm not being apologetic. about loving someone who is behind the wall. I have a little bit of knowledge about the law. I have a little bit of knowledge about the counseling aspect of what goes on with that. I have some background with, you know, talking with families before individuals get out of prison to see if this is going to work as a stable household that can be supportive of a person that's been incarcerated. Because if they're gone long enough, you don't know them, they don't know you. And the system kind of makes it like that. When Shaka caught his case, Shaka was in college. You know, he was moving forward. He had a job. You know, now you have a grandchild. You're building a stronger foundation with your son, and his son is what kept him going all those years that, you know, that he wasn't there. And him and his son were extremely close. And I don't know if people realize, you know, that when something is taken away from you, and you come from an environment where it's an eye for an eye, that something that closely taken away from you can cause you to become mentally ill at that particular moment. Grieving in and of itself is a type of mental illness. And everybody doesn't handle it the same way. And to feel helpless, I can only imagine. I'm not a man. I don't have the pressures that society places on men. You know, you got a man up, you know, and this, that, and the other. I'm not in that position, so I can't say I feel every pain that he feels. I know my pain. I feel like one of my sons was killed. Mm-hmm. Okay, he was murdered. It wasn't a drug situation. You know, he's walking out of a door, and it's over the young woman's house. He walks out, and next thing you know, he's been killed by a shotgun blast from another kid who has issues about him speaking to the young lady, or, you know, so things like that. When people know kind of what has happened. And we were all in the circle together prior to him being locked up. And people knowing me before I knew Shaka, they knew that, you know, once I decide that I'm going to sign on to something, I don't just quit because the going gets tough. That to me is not the example of what I want to see this society turn into. And it's not so much that I'm so worried about me as it is what I see happening to other people, like I said, who don't have support systems, and they don't have a voice, and they don't know how to use the voice that they have in a constructive way to have people listen to them and take them serious. You'd be surprised at how many people actually have either had a loved one locked up or they're going through it right now. They never talk about it. They're very isolated, and the more rural area you live in, the more that isolation takes place. The smaller the city, the worse you feel, because everybody knows your business. We have changed in this nation. We have gone from corrective behavior from the very beginning. Then you went to punishment. Then you went to warehousing. And if you look at the history of incarceration and how we are where we are now, it starts off as a way of changing behaviors, correcting behaviors. You know, you got the Quakers and all that. Then you're going to move on to right after emancipation, you're going to have a way for free labor, because you're going to be arresting people of color for just standing on the sidewalk, and they can do from one day to now on. There was no real length of time, depending on where you were arrested at. They weren't real stringent on you getting out on time. Then you go to warehousing people. And the truth of the matter is, you're never going to have enough jobs to solve all the problems that have been created up under capitalism. Because capitalism is all about the dollar. And you're only somebody if you've got this many of them. Whereas you can have a billionaire can do a crime, they never do a day. You have someone who's poor, it doesn't matter what color they are, if they don't have the money, they're going to do the time. But people are competing, and when people are competing, people see themselves as either me or you. And our society is a me or you society. And what prison has really been able to do is to really divide poor people. Because I don't care if you're black, white, or whatever, when you go behind the wall, you're not free any longer, and you're going to run into those blockades, okay? Blacks not going to want to work with whites if they're locked up, and Hispanics, everybody's got their own little team, same way they do out here. But it's a little bit more controlled because the guards have a lot to do with who gets what privileges. And our society works on privilege. If I feel like I'm going to lose a privilege, I'm going to stand tall on don't take away my privilege. But people will say it's wrong, but nobody wants to be the sacrificial goat. And so you got to get tough on crime. Yet crime went down, but incarceration goes up. And it goes up because whereas you used to get time that was reasonable, now you're getting this outrageous time. And if you don't know, you don't even realize that it costs you more to keep a person in prison for 65, 70 years in the long run out of your taxpayer dollars than it does to actually put in some real items or classes or training that's going to help the individuals look at life differently so that they can make a living without having to be predatory. I love your generation because you all see life a lot different than your predecessors. It's not about so much the big house. Now they're selling tiny houses for as much as they do mansions. But it's a logic to, I don't need all of this to be who I am. I'm not trying to prove that I need to do this in order for me to be validated. And so you see more people of every ethnicity taking to the streets and saying, you know, enough of this is enough. What are we going to put in its place? We'll try it when we get there, but we can't keep going in the direction that we're going. And so when you've got people, like I said, who have their own personal issues that have not been dealt with, and they're put in positions of power to misuse and abuse individuals, that makes it three times as hard to change things because I'm not going to sacrifice. I don't want to be a whistleblower because I don't want to lose my job because I need this job to feed my family or to pay for my car or whatever. Plus, it makes me feel good about me because bad as life might be, at least I'm not that person. And you don't even know that person's story. So that's kind of what keeps me focused. It keeps me grounded that it's not how long you live. It's what you do with while you're living. And if you don't stand for anything, then you just miss, you're another walking dead. Whichever way the wind blows, that's where you're going to go. And nothing changes. And so then when you come to the end of your life, you have nothing to be celebratory about your life. You have a hard time leaving because you know you haven't done anything to make a difference in anybody's life. And that's what happens when we throw people behind bars. They become a commodity that we can bargain with to keep the economic parts of society afloat because you don't need people set free from prison, and then you got the people who were working in the prison because the prison's been closed down. Now you got just that many more people that are out there looking for a job. And where are all these jobs? Because if you're in a job, you must produce something. Well, if no one has any money to buy what you're producing, then give me a break. This is how we get into wars. You got to open a market somewhere else. And our market is housing inmates. And guards are just as much locked up as inmates because they're doing 12 to 16 hours in there. They go home, get 8 hours of sleep, and then they go back to prison. That's the only difference. There are some that do abuse their power. Bars may give people false courage just like guns do. You know, it's one is, to me, is not much difference except for the one can make you a non-breathing dead. The other one can leave people as walking dead. And when I say walking dead, it leaves them hopeless. It leaves them angry. It leaves them without any avenues to make things work. And so they're just here. And if I'm a walking dead, I'm very dangerous because I don't have any reason to care about you because I've never felt like nobody cared about me when I was in a situation that I needed help. And then our courts, they're very political. They are not non-biased. They're not what people think they are. And it's sad to say that over 85% of people in prison did not go to trial. It was a plea bargain. They scared you into taking something. You know? So you didn't really get a fair shake of your peers. And lawyers are in it for the money. So you got all of these things that people have to deal with. You know, how much money can you spend in a lifetime trying to save a life?
especially if you work in just one job, unless you hit the lottery, you know, and I have my conspiracy theories about who wins that too. Children get involved in all of this and how they're overlooked, you know, in regards to there's data out there, you know, scientific data, and there are some groups around the country that are trying some different things, but it's more like you look at it in parts instead of looking at it holistically, because whoever is the caregiver of that child needs to be just as involved in helping that child do their time along with that parent or that loved one. I'm that person that if you ask me a question, don't ask me if you don't want the truth. If you can't handle the truth, then don't ask me again, because it's not going to change. And I'm not trying to hurt your feelings, but out of respect, I tell you the truth. If I don't respect you, not only am I not going to talk to you, but I may say anything just to get away from you.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, truth is the biggest way you show respect to people. And I trust you at who you say you are until I see differently. And people can be wishy-washy. You know, people, they get on the team because it's popular. I always tell certain people, be careful of the photo ops. Okay, you know, you out there at the photo op because they're going to take pictures, don't be in a paper, yada, yada, yada. But when it's really time to buckle down and get the work done, we can't find you. Because that's a quick way to lose credibility. And so I know people in the lowest of places, and I know some people in some very high places. And the consistency of what people will say is, just what you see is just what you get. I want to see more support groups set up for families of incarcerated around everywhere. Because out of that, we can find ways to address these issues that are being swept under the rug in regards to what's going on inside a prison, too. Because everybody's got a story.
If you are interested in participating in or learning more about support groups for family and friends of incarcerated people, please email Akili at akilishakur@yahoo.com or kitelineradio@gmail.com. Now we'll hear from Willie about the recent increase in law enforcement efforts to target and deport undocumented folks in the U.S. and the local response from support communities like Undocu Hoosier Alliance.
So my name's Willie Palomo. I'm a second-year graduate student at Indiana University Bloomington, a master's and MFA in poetry, and then a master's in Latin American and Caribbean studies. The group I'm with is the Undocu Hoosier Alliance. We spend a lot of our efforts fundraising for undocumented student scholarships and also for legal aid for undocumented people in Indiana, bail bonds for detention centers and also for immigration lawyers. And we've given more than thousands of dollars to both of these causes now, so we're always fundraising for this. You can find our fundraising link on our Facebook page, which is Undocu Hoosier Alliance, and also you can find it in DocuHoosierAlliance.com. You can also sign up for a listserv there, and through our listserv and through our Facebook, we're always putting up action steps that the community can take. It can range from something small as emailing or calling an administrator about a certain issue we're passionate about, or showing up for a rally, or if it comes down to it, active resistance against ICE raids and stuff like that. So that's something, if you want to step up to the plate and actively resist, it's definitely a good place to start and to be following locally in Bloomington. And also Indiana Undocumented Youth Alliance, if you aren't following them yet, they lead a lot of the actions statewide. So we've recently had the 75th anniversary of the Japanese internment camps, and that's been something that people have been talking about, and they've been talking about how, like, never again, often in context of the Muslim population of the U.S. and the risk of another sort of internment camp happening. The second I heard people saying never again, I was like, that's already happening when you're thinking about undocumented people. In 2013, according to the Detention Watch Network, there was 441,000 undocumented people who were already incarcerated in these detention centers, which is roughly like four times the amount that were incarcerated in these concentration camps during the World War II era for people of Japanese ancestry. So this is already happening. How do we resist what is happening right now? The other conversations that have been difficult that undocumented activist group have been wrestling with throughout the nation is right now there's definitely DACA recipients being incarcerated under Trump's new immigration raids and sweeps, some of them being targeted. There's the case that blew up last week with Danielle, who was a DACA recipient in Washington. Without saying anything too specific about it, as we're aware of Indiana University Bloomington student or students, the information's still really unclear now, who have been detained as well. And there's a lot of fear surrounding these raids and people being detained. At what point is like spreading this information harmful for the community? Like the Washington activists have been taking a bit of heat for putting out so much fear into the community that DACA recipients might start being targeted. Where we don't know whether that's the case now. It's just that fear is there. So the way we handle these conversations needs to be careful as just activists in the community. Things to keep in mind about the detention centers is when we call them concentration camps, we're not playing around with that terminology. They're very degrading spaces. My family members from El Salvador who came across and stayed at the detention centers after they turned themselves into Border Patrol would speak to us about sleeping on concrete floors, about being put in purposefully cold rooms, like air conditioning at an absurdly low temperature. And we know that throughout detention centers, sexual assault and abuse is rampant, especially when it comes to transgender and gender nonconforming people. One inspiring action that has taken place in Indiana is that they were trying to build a detention center in Gary, Indiana, and Black Lives Matter activists and immigration rights activists came together to shut it down. And a lot of what shut down this company that was trying to come in was the fact that there's well-documented sexual abuse that they have participated in and basically condoned on the part of their security guards. So when we're talking about the conditions these people are living in, it's oftentimes very degrading. If you see the pictures of it, there's whole communities just stuffed into small rooms and really cramped conditions. And when they leave, like, one of my aunts had to live basically a year with an ankle bracelet on, even though, like, she hadn't committed any crime. The most threatening thing she did was try to save her family from gang violence in El Salvador, which is horrific right now. El Salvador had more murders in 2015 than they had at the peak of their civil war. So it's very warlike conditions, even though it's a technically peacetime country. And she had to wear an ankle bracelet for a year, do all of these check-ins, which is another form of incarceration, right? Monitoring people and making them feel like they are incarcerated even when they're not in the jail space. It's really important to keep in mind that prisons in the U.S. right now, detention centers in the U.S. right now, have very horrific conditions just because of overpopulation, trying to cut costs while maximizing profit with free labor. One thing that's like fraught for me, that's complex, that I'm frustrated with, but I am also happy to start seeing, like, you, once the no ban, no wall stuff started happening with the executive orders, you see the kind of outpour of allies doing the work of showing up. Part of it, all of a sudden, it's like, wow, we would have really appreciated you guys like 3 months ago or a year ago, you know, where have you been? We've been fighting this, you know. Obama deported more undocumented people and has detained more undocumented people than any president in history. So it is a fight that we should have been consistently fighting with everyone. Watching social media has been especially frustrating when people spread information about misinformation about raids, you know, just copying and pasting Facebook statuses. And not only that, but not offering, like, alongside that, like, hey, there's a raid happening, resources that could be helpful for people. Like, oh, there was some going on in Utah and some going on in Denver, and I have a lot of friends in these states, and for each one I was putting, Drum has released basically a guide on like how to handle like reports of ICE raids. So I was posting that, and I was posting Know Your Rights information, because if there's a raid happening, like Know Your Rights information is the sort of thing that you want the most vulnerable populations to be aware of. And organized resistance would be very important, like just copying and pasting a Facebook status. If it's actually happening and you know where, like a lot of these statuses claim, get off your computer and go like body block. Go get in front of these ICE vans if they're actually there. So there's a lot of this fear going without a lot of concrete action, preparing our communities and empowering our communities, which is really important, because there was two people detained in Bloomington last Tuesday, and there was a lot of fear going around Bloomington, trying to get more information, trying to get networks to respond. And because of that, a lot of the undocumented community in Bloomington has been fearful. There was people leaving work, there was people not taking their kids to school because they're afraid of being picked up, people looking for places to go because they're fearful of ICE showing up at their house if it was a raid. That creates a ton of problems for the community, right? Like, living in fear isn't a good thing, especially when we could be giving people information to help protect them. Like, if ICE comes at your door, do not open the door unless they have a warrant. If they do have a warrant, having powers of attorney set up so that people can do things in your name, like if parents are separated from children, so that people can still take care of the children legally. There's a lot of steps that can be taken to help prepare communities in a worst case scenario. And the Undocu-Hoosier Alliance and Indiana Undocumented Youth Alliance have been trying to get Know Your Rights workshops set up, knowing that this tidal wave of ICE activity was going to happen. But since the targeted arrests happened in Bloomington on Tuesday, the leaders of the Latinx community and other community partners finally woke up and were like, oh, we have to do a Know Your Rights thing. And this is something that the Undocu-Hoosier Alliance has been trying to set up for months, but just didn't have the human power to do. So it's wonderful to see them finally come together, but it's frustrating that it's reactionary rather than proactive. Now, for my family, for like friends I know, there's people who are starting to get picked up when they just go through their routine court appointments, who had something on their record that before wasn't a problem. It wasn't going to have them deported. But now, because the definition, the criminal acts has been expanded, they're at risk. And the next time they show up, they're being arrested. So it's important to prepare communities for those situations, and then preparing our allies and accomplices to stand in solidarity with us with active resistance against these ICE raids and targeted arrests.
This has been KiteLine. Anyone affected by the prison system in any form is welcome to write us via our P.O. Box, KiteLine Radio, P.O. Box 2422, Bloomington, Indiana, 47402. KiteLine wants your feedback. You can reach us via email at kitelineradio@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Are you or someone you care about affected by the prison system? You can call us to record a message to be played on the air at 812-269-2512, or you can use this number to record a message to a loved one behind bars. You can hear previous episodes of our show or get more information on the prisoners or stories covered on KiteLine at our website, kitelineradio.noblogs.org. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. KiteLine is intended as a means of communication between people across prison walls. We are not responsible for all views expressed on the program. WFHB, its contributors, or any affiliates airing this program are not responsible for the views expressed on the show. This has been KiteLine. Join us every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for more stories, news, and insights about the impact of prison on our communities. Thank you for listening.
That was part of a recent episode of KiteLine in Bloomington, Indiana, about creating support in communities targeted by law enforcement and prison systems. To hear the full episode, you can visit wfhb.org.
Desta Black Youth Network, a nonprofit organization located in Montreal's neighborhood of Little Burgundy, an organization dedicated to empowering Black youth in the areas of education, health and personal development, and advocacy, also offers support to community members of all ages who are in prison or who have been impacted by the criminal justice system. Through their justice program, DESTA can provide the following services to prisoners: informal counseling over the phone, available by collect call at 514-932-3242. advocacy and referrals with parole officers, halfway house, and community visits to Cowansville Institution. Desta says that prisoners are welcome to call on Tuesdays and Thursdays between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for more information. The number for collect calls is 514-932-3242. Desta says they look forward to hearing from those contacting them about these services. On our last show, we aired the entire first episode of a new podcast about prison called Rust Belt Abolition Radio. We like the show so much that we wanted to share an interview with you from their second podcast. This interview is with Abraham Paulos from the organization Families for Freedom, and it's about the ways that the organization works towards migrant justice and prison abolition.
I'm Maria, joining Kaif Syed, and you're listening to Rust Belt Abolition Radio, an abolitionist media and movement building project based in Detroit, Michigan.
In this show, we amplify the voices of those impacted by mass incarceration and explore ongoing work in our movement to abolish the carceral state. That is, prisons, police, courts, as well as racial domination and capitalist exploitation.
What does a world without prisons, police, and property look like? What kind of society becomes possible when we stop maintaining nations and neighborhoods in which specific populations become fundamentally criminalized? These are the kinds of questions that abolitionists ask.
Prison abolition isn't just about letting go of an old form of solving problems, putting people in cages. It also entails reshaping the ways in which we relate with one another, in all scales.
Now, we turn to Alejo Stark for an interview with Abraham Paulos.
A. Maria and I spoke with Abraham Paulos, Executive Director of Families for Freedom, on the ways in which his organization works towards migrant justice and prison abolition.
My name is Abraham Paulos. I was born in Sudan. I came to the United States as a refugee before the age of one. I grew up in Chicago during the 80s and 90s in poverty or what have you. I had contact with the criminal system. Not only that, but family members have been affected by detention and deportation. I was picked up in Brooklyn 5 years ago for a robbery that happened on my block. I ended up going through the system, the precinct, booking, and it was in Rikers Island, is a city jail in New York City. And it was there that a fellow prisoner of mine had told me about Immigration Customs Enforcement having an office and the access that they had to the jail to deport non-citizens, you know, who were convicted of certain crimes or what have you. And so I was able to bond out. I was able to bail out thanks to the knowledge that this prisoner had, and came out, looked for a lot of organizations to help out. Not a lot of organizations would, due to the criminal conviction and due to the fact that I was a non-citizen. Families for Freedom was an organization that was there that helped me out with my case. And after a year of becoming a member, I've been the executive director ever since. So it's been about 5 years.
Can you tell me about the work that Families for Freedom does, and how does it differ from other migrant justice organizations?
I think what makes us different is that, one, we fight by and stand by those that have been convicted of crime who were not born here. When we say we stand by them, I mean, we really do mean that. Because of our critique of the criminal legal system, a system in which 92 to 97% of people who are in front of a judge plead guilty. The second point that I want to make is about an analysis that we have. You know, we're abolitionists. We do not believe in detention. We do not believe in prison. We do not think that the problem with prison situation in the United States is that there are too many prisons. We do not think that that is the problem. We think that the fact that there are prisons, and that is the problem. We think that this goes beyond getting citizenship, right? I don't think that in our community, citizenship is what folks really want. I mean, I think we come from a space in which, you know, our community needs to be free from the fear of deportation and detention. And one of the things I always say is that we didn't have a prison problem during slavery, right? There was a reason for that. I can't even name a prison during slavery. So that analysis of really understanding that this is about resources for our community and for our people is really where we come from, and that's where we stand. You know, it's not a solution. Prison is not a solution to the lack of resources that we have in our community. Deportation is not a solution to an immigration system. That is the analysis that we really bring to it. I mean, we do believe in open borders, and we don't think that that's a crazy ask at all, because if you are a U.S. citizen with a passport, and particularly if you have money and you're white, you know, you live in an open border world. There hardly is any country that would not accept you, maybe North Korea, Somalia. So folks are living in an open border world. It's just, it's not for everyone, and we question why it's not for everyone.
Late last year, you moderated a phenomenal panel with longtime prison abolitionists Ruth Wilson Gilmore, Maryam Kaba, and Mujahid Farid that was organized by Critical Resistance. What does abolition mean to you, and what are the concrete practices that Families for Freedom engages to further abolition?
I think abolition for me just really means that these aren't solutions, and their own existence, the fundamental existence of prison, is racist and capitalist, and so it's flawed. And so, like I said earlier, I was like, well, there were no prisons during slavery, and why were there no prisons during slavery? Because there was this economic industry that essentially, you know, Black people were free labor, and we were basically where they wanted us to be. So I think abolition really is about abolishing the fundamental premise of white supremacy and capitalism as a reason for anything, really. And I think abolitionists really look at it in such a way in which we understand, like, for me, it's about resources. So don't tell me we need prison when you don't give us food, housing, jobs. And then I think once we get those resources, then we can see if we need these things, which I highly doubt it. And it's also, you know, there are people living in an abolitionist world, you know, people that are walking around and don't have to worry about prisons like we do. They don't have to worry about police officers like we have to worry about police officers, right? There's no police officers in the Hamptons like they are in Brooklyn, you know? So that exists already. That reality exists already, but we're denied it. And why are we denied it? And that's because white supremacy and capitalism. So that's what abolitionist just means to me, is abolishing fundamental premises that are rooted in white supremacy and capitalism. And so how do we move forward with that? It is a long, hard road. In the beginning, the first conversations were around mandatory detention, saying we were against mandatory detention. And then it was like, okay, well, we want to end all immigration detention. And then we thought about it and said, well, aren't we throwing other Black and brown people under the bus? And so, you know, we got to a place that basically said, look, we want no prisons, essentially. On the practical look at things, I mean, I think one of the things is that because we're abolitionists, we do not turn anyone away because of their criminal conviction. We don't care what it is, because it really doesn't matter. Because if you have this analysis, particularly towards the prison industrial complex, you can't be an abolitionist and then run around and start saying, oh, well, we're not going to take folks that have these types of criminal convictions or violent convictions or what have you. That's one concrete thing that we do, is that we do not have a hierarchy for criminal convictions. So anyone that comes to us will not get turned away for the type of criminal conviction that they have.
Can you also tell us a little bit about, you know, in relation to kind of what Families for Freedom does? You were talking about your different kind of analysis, right? Race and class being kind of central, and freedom rather than citizenship being the kind of long-term goal. What possibilities do you see and challenges, I guess, in this historical conjuncture we find ourselves in?
So I'll try to break that down piece by piece. Citizenship is not the goal for us, because we also understand that there are citizens here, Black people who are citizens, brown people who are citizens, going through pretty much a lot. No housing, no food, no student loans, whatever, no school. So citizenship hasn't really brought us access to rights and services like it should, right? And so that's never the goal, long-term or short-term. Yes, it's great if people can get citizenship, but really the only reason why we would get that is to be free from the fear of deportation.
What is your response to folks that are pushing sanctuary cities now and working within the state?
I get it. You know, it's cute. Right now, what I would say, real practically, people have to be clear about who the sanctuary is for. Folks are running with this term and they're being reckless, and they're getting people in our community hurt. You can't be running around and saying we're a sanctuary city when you don't provide sanctuary for Black and brown people, when the police are still on the block, or people with weapons. This is a division tactic, because they're only going to provide sanctuary for a certain type. They're only going to save the ones that they want to save. They're only going to be a sanctuary for undocumented immigrants who don't have criminal convictions. But one thing I want to say, is to get it real practical, is I think there needs to be a clear definition of who is worthy in their eyes of sanctuary, so that our community doesn't get hurt running around thinking that they're living in a sanctuary city when they're actually not. That's reckless. And to be weary about those that are calling for a sanctuary if they're not willing to, like, open up their home.
Thank you so much, Abraham.
Yeah, you got this all.
That was an interview with Abraham Paulos from the organization Families for Freedom. The interview was done by folks from the Rust Belt Abolition Radio Project, a new podcast based in Detroit, Michigan. You can check out the entire episode of that podcast at soundcloud.com/Rust Belt Abolition Radio. In the context of the Week Against Police Brutality, a discussion hosted by Robin Maynard on incarceration and political repression with Albert Woodfox and Robert H. King is going to be taking place next week, Friday, March 17th at 6 p.m. at the Alumni Auditorium, room H110 of the Henry F. Hall Building, which is at 1455 de Maisonneuve West of Concordia University. Albert Woodfox is a Black Panther activist and ex-political prisoner who was released in February 2016 at the age of 69 after having been detained and tortured for 45 years at the Angola Penitentiary in Louisiana. He spent 43 years in solitary confinement. No American prisoner has ever been put in solitary confinement for so long. This cruel and unusual punishment was inflicted on him for a crime he did not commit because of his political beliefs and the color of his skin. With Herman Wallace and Robert King, Albert Woodfox was part of a group known as the Angola Three, three African-American men sent to prison in 1971 in one of the most violent detention facilities in the United States. They were members of the Black Panthers, and they fought to defend prisoners' rights while they were inside prison. Robert King stayed in Angola for 32 years. He spent 29 years in solitary confinement, and from the time that he got out in 2001, he crusaded to free his two friends. Wallace was released in 2013, but died shortly thereafter. Since Woodfox discovered his freedom, or recovered his freedom, in February 2016, he's been traveling Europe and the U.S. with King to advocate for the abolition of solitary confinement and the liberation of political prisoners in the United States. They will all be speaking. They will both be speaking at this event, which again is being hosted by Robin Maynard. The event is free and wheelchair accessible, and there will be translation provided into French and Spanish. Again, the event is taking place Friday, March 17th at 6 p.m. in room H110 of Concordia University's Hall Building, which is located at 1455 de Maisonneuve West.
My name is Robert H. King. I'm one of the freed members of the Angola 3. You're listening to the Prison Radio Show at CKUT.ca on 90.3 FM.
The time is presently 5:56, and you've been listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. You can check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Prison Radio Show. The Prison Radio Show airs twice a month on CKUT. We're on the air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday at 11 a.m. The next episode of the Prison Radio Show will air on Friday, March 24th at 11 a.m. If you have any questions on anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, feel free to contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. Folks can also leave a message on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. If you're in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. Feel free to write us at The Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, postal code H3A2B3.
Thanks for tuning into this rebroadcast episode of The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Virginia.
My name is Noah.
And we've been your hosts for today. Please stay tuned.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.